I celebrate myself, and what I assume, you shall assume.
You couldn't really tell it was a poem. Parts of it were sort of dirty. So how did Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass become the first masterpiece of American poetry?
Whitman was a visionary, and we, as a society, are not ready for Whitman. We're not ready for his radical egalitarianism. We're not ready for his sexuality.
Today in Studio 360, how a poet taught America to sing a song of itself and created an American icon. And I'll talk with one of the most beloved singers for my generation, Linda Ronstadt. After a 40-year career, she explains why she won't sing again.
I can't get to the note. It's like taking the elevator. You push 9, you go to 13, you know?
That and more is ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, celebrating 10 years of making their own tracks with the limited edition Scion 10 series. The vehicles are available now. You can learn more about the limited edition Scion 10 series features and music release downloads at scion.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Later in the show, we'll talk to a dance company who've performed with unmanned aerial vehicles. You know, drones.
We started out by saying, what do they do? We said, could you land it on our head? Could you land it on the floor? Could you land it on our nose? The choreographers were making engineering suggestions, and the engineers were making choreographic suggestions.
But first, pop singers are lucky to record one hit song, tour for a while, get to do another album or two, but very few have been able to get famous, grow up with their audience, stay famous, and continue making hits. Linda Ronstadt was one of those fortunate few. She was the most successful and maybe the most loved female singer of her time. And you show me a sign, and I'll be willing to be moving. And she endured by scrambling genres, landing on the country and the pop charts with the same songs, and then went on to sing operetta, Mexican ballads, American standards, and lots more. Now she has written a memoir called Simple Dreams, and a few weeks ago announced that her singing days are done. Linda Ronstadt, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much for having me.
The case you make in the book is that the range of music you were exposed to as a kid in the 1950s, I guess, and early 60s was sort of a well you kept drawing from for your whole career. I want to play this Mexican ballad that you apparently learned as a girl. El cañal está en su punto, hoy comienza la molienda.
El trapiche está de duelo y suspira en cada vuelta.
So you actually seem moved once again these years later hearing yourself sing that.
Well, it's not me. It's the music. It's the song. You know, that's a beautiful, beautiful song about a huapanguero. The huapango is a certain kind of Mexican song that's you hear in the mountains. Where you break into a thrilling kind of soaring yodel. And there's certain people that can really do it well, and they're revered, you know, in the culture. That song talks about a mill turning around to grind the sugar cane, and the Rogaciano, this thrilling singer, has died, and everyone's in mourning, and the whole entire countryside, even the mill, when it moves around, it sighs, you know, every time it makes a revolution. You know, it's a beautiful, beautiful, rich song. I love it.
And growing up in Arizona and having Spanish songs as part of your...
Mexican songs,
Spanish language songs. Was there something, as you heard songs like that as a kid, that made you say, I can do that, or I really, really want to do that?
I always wanted to do that. And when we were kids, everybody in my family sang in Spanish and English. You know, everybody was bilingual completely, except for me. And I thought that Spanish was a language you sang in, and English was what you spoke. But if there was a party or some kind of a celebration, you know, the guitars would come out and people would start singing in two languages, and we'd crawl up into somebody's lap and fall asleep with this wonderful male voices in my family, all rich, beautiful, deep baritone voices.
And speaking of going to bed and going to sleep to music, I in the book, I love the songs that you say your mother and father would sing to you at bedtime. They are really, really dark, like some Roald Dahl murder ballad.
Aren't they?
Yeah. I wish
my parents were so nice.
I mean, Leave It to Beaver never had songs like this. If you could maybe just
read
some.
Yeah, that wasn't the truth. Nobody believed that stuff, really.
Some of the lyrics of the one your mom sang?
She'd sing, "Last night my darling baby died. She died committing suicide. Some say she died despite us of spinal meningitis. She was a nasty baby anyway."
So not only grotesque and mean, but funny.
We sang back to her, "Oh, don't go in the cage tonight, mother darling, for the lions are ferocious and may bite. And when they get their angry fits, they may tear you all to bits. So don't go in the lion's cage tonight."
And
was in harmony, we would sing this
in story. Spanish?
In English.
In English.
Yeah.
Done right, that sounds like, again, instead of being a purely idyllic childhood, that gives it a nice edge.
Well, my father would sing to us a beautiful song that he learned from his mother from northern Mexico. It was called, "Arriba en el cielo se vive un coyote con ojos de plata y los pies de azogue." Up in the sky there lives a coyote with silver eyes and feet of mercury. Kill it for a thief. From underneath the floor there goes a rat. Kill it with a stake.
And was this just
very soothing?
I mean, what was it about them that chose to present you, darling little Linda, with these songs?
Well, maybe parents just get so desperate they'll threaten you with anything. If you don't shut up, the rat's going to come and get you, you know. I don't know. The coyote with the quicksilver eyes, that's a lovely image. I thought
totally.
That was nice.
In the book, you kind of skip the point where you get your big break, or maybe you didn't get one big break and it was instead a gradual
process. It was kind of like that,
in your early 20s. But when it was happening in the late 60s, was that scary? Were you self-conscious about performing, about being famous?
I was pretty self-conscious about not being very good yet. You know,
really?
I think that it takes a long time to learn to do anything well. And I took about 10 years to learn how to sing. I mean, I was just really kind of wandering around in the dark trying to copy.
Really? So until 1976, you couldn't really sing?
I didn't really think so. And really, maybe not until after 1980 was when I really got going. Yeah.
So there you were, Linda Ronstadt, and you really felt – did at the time in 1977 you feel like, I'm not really all I should be?
I thought that very strongly, and I wanted to do more, and I wanted to do stuff that was a very custom fit not only to my voice but to my sensibility, you know. And I grew up with this wacky background in the desert, you know. It's not like everybody else. And I grew up bicultural. A lot of the songs that I'd heard when I was a child I thought were better songs than some of the mainstream pop things – a lot of the mainstream pop things that I was getting. I thought they were better. I wanted to do them.
You talk in the book about this turning point when you see Emmylou Harris for the first time and you are hugely impressed with her talent and make this conscious decision to like her. I'm going to like her even though I'm jealous of her great ability. I want to play you singing with Emmylou and Dolly Parton, "Do I Ever Cross Your Mind?"
And when I think of you and the love we once knew, on old memories like that, or do I ever cross your mind?
I never have been very competitive in terms of art. I think competition is a good thing for a horse race, but I think that she was doing what I was doing, exactly what I was trying to do, and she, in my opinion, she was doing it much better, and I think she still does. But you know what?
Although she only, to be fair, was only doing one part of all of the things.
Yeah, but I hadn't done all those other things yet. And I was chasing country rock at the time, and Chris Hillman had told me that he was sure we were going to like each other. He had such respect for Emmy, and I knew I was going to like her. It was something very extraordinary that happened up on that stage that night, and I thought, okay, I already loved her. So I thought, I can love her, and I can be jealous, and it'll spoil every note I ever hear that she sings, or I can just love her and just admire and step back and admire, and maybe I'll get to sing with her.
And it worked out.
So she was busy singing with Graham at the time, but, you know, eventually I got to sing with her. Best decision I ever made, by
really?
The way, emotionally, best decision. And I kept it that way.
And did it last beyond Emmylou Harris? And did it, like,
with everything else I've ever encountered like that? I mean, I never was particularly afflicted of the green-eyed monster, but that was a time I just told it to f*** off, you know.
I was interested that as you moved to these bigger and bigger venues and were playing arenas and kind of hated them and hated the sound and hated the aesthetic of that performative experience,
yeah.
That's when you said, okay, I'm going to sing opera. I'm going to do Gilbert and Sullivan. Well,
that was operetta.
I know.
I wanted to
but
be –
But La Boheme, opera.
The Greeks had it right, you know, when they designed the proscenium stage. A theater is there to give you an experience of magical reality. And there are a lot of processes that change your mind. You know, you walk in and you're in the entryway there in the lobby, and already you've made a deliberate attempt to separate yourself from the people on the street that are going to do whatever, and you're going to go see this show. So if you're in a real theater, it's like a machine to get people to pay attention to you. Now, if you're in one of those sporting arenas, people are out buying a beer, they're buying a hot dog, they're passing a joint, they're checking out what their girlfriend's wearing.
Watching the moon, yeah.
Yeah, anything. You have to struggle hard. And now, I just wanted to sing in a real theater with a curtain. Isn't that stupid?
No.
I wanted a curtain and a proscenium.
Really? It wasn't. It
was a sound system.
But it was
sure. Lights.
All that. But I'm sure. But wasn't it kind of a stubborn, I can't be pigeonholed. I can do this too. And I can do this too.
And I just wanted to do something that was really good. You know, people really listened and you were really doing it, like you're really on stage doing it right.
Was there anything – I mean, you tried so many different things and, you know, these – really? Linda Ronstadt's doing that? Really? Linda Ronstadt's doing that? Was there ever anything you wanted to do that you just didn't get to in that sense?
I was just thinking about that in the car on the way over. I wish I could have sung Kurt Weill until it came out my ears. I love – oh, God. I love songs from the Three Penny Opera. I love Mahogany. I love September Song. Oh, God, I want to sing September Song, and I can't sing.
When you started talking last month about how you have been diagnosed with Parkinson's and apparently have had it for some years, you said, and you can't sing, and you haven't been able to sing for years. What does that mean, that you can't sing to your satisfaction? You can sing better than I can, no doubt.
No, I can't sing at all. The muscles – see, Parkinson's particularly affects your muscles.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with the muscles, but there's a guy, you know, sitting in your brain, you know, making a phone call to the muscle saying, move in this certain exquisite way. I can't get to the note. It's like taking the elevator. You push 9, you go to 13. You know? You know, eventually you freeze with Parkinson's disease.
Yeah. I mean, do you want to be involved in music if you can't sing or?
Well, I am involved in music because a big part of it is hearing. I mean, music is 99% hearing. And the other 1%, it's like visual art. It's 99% seeing and the rest is what you can draw. I'm involved with a group in Northern California in the East Bay called Los Ensondles. And I've been involved with them for 20-plus years, and they do an amazing job in a little strip mall of teaching children, mostly immigrants' children, traditional Mexican music, and these children come out really knowing how to use music for their life.
So before I let you go, I want you to choose which of your songs that we should play you out on. Which is the best one that people should leave this conversation hearing?
Well, I think maybe I'd like to play the last thing I ever recorded as a solo artist. I had learned to recraft my singing voice at that point. I was kind of doing the best I could with what I had. I had found a different way to tell a story. And it's a record that I made with John Boylan, who was there in the beginning. We sort of came around full circle. It's called Just Tell Him I Said Hello.
That it shall be. Linda Ronstadt, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me.
Linda Ronstadt's new memoir, Simple Dreams, is out right now. If he should ask you, but he won't, I know, 'cause it's all over and forgotten. Just tell him I said hello. Coming up, quick question. Are you worried about the new age of surveillance? And if so, which scares you more, drones or that cell phone in your pocket?
One of the reasons drones get such a bad reputation is because we can actually visualize them. And this is something where we're getting it from the movies. We can visualize in our head that a UAV or a drone could be coming after us and spying on us.
We'll home in on drones next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, celebrating 10 years of making their own tracks with the limited edition Scion 10 series. The vehicles are available now. You can learn more about the limited edition Scion 10 series features and music release downloads at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
There's been a lot of talk about the Americans using drones against people linked to Al-Qaeda.
Drones are remotely controlled aircraft. They're much more maneuverable.
The president has the legal authority to use unmanned drones to kill
U.S. drones targeting American citizens.
Not many years ago, drones were a topic only in the news because they were being used by the CIA and our military in Afghanistan and Pakistan to kill bad guys. For a long time, drones were intended to be secret, and they're definitely futuristic, which is why they've so taken hold of our imaginations. It didn't take long before they became a staple of pop culture, showing up in movies like The Bourne Legacy and TV shows like Homeland.
Someone meeting us at the gate.
They have a drone ready.
They're fueling one now.
At 4:42 p.m. local time, a drone missile hit and destroyed part of a compound.
Take the target out.
Roger. Target destroyed.
But Americans, if you ask them, have ambivalent feelings about drones. Overseas, maybe. Here in America, they make us nervous. Studio 360's Eric Malinsky talked to a few artists who are exploring the way we think and feel about drones.
It's Friday afternoon. I'm deep into Brooklyn at one of those art studios that used to be a factory.
Hey, Adam.
Hey, come on up.
Thanks.
Surveillance and privacy are big themes in Adam Harvey's artwork. That's why he likes to keep an eye on military blogs. Recently, he became fascinated with thermal imaging, which is how drone pilots see the world.
Okay, so if you look at thermal images, they're black and white, and the warm parts of you are white, and the cool parts are black.
That's how drones find people, looking for heat signatures.
And the tip of your nose will be a little bit darker than your face, because it's always a little bit cooler. And it's not a flattering image by any means.
But that gave Adam an idea. What if you could design a piece of clothing that made a person invisible to drones?
This is silver metallized fabric.
He went through like 50 different fabrics until he found the right combination of wearability and heat retention.
Okay, here's the anti-drone hijab.
Yep. He designed them in the shape of hijabs and burqas. They're very shiny. No one would mistake this for desert camouflage. But he showed me a thermal image of a woman wearing a stealthwear hijab. And her head and shoulders are completely blacked out.
Black blends into the background, yeah.
Right now, they're expensive prototypes. Eventually, he hopes to have them made to order, because he says stealthwear is armor for the information age. And if a burqa isn't your style, he designed a stealthwear hoodie.
Hey, we're in the middle of a war, and that war is taking place abroad, but it's also taking place here in the form of surveillance. So everyone is walking this new battlefield physically and digitally.
A number of artists are creating works about drones these days, but Alex Rivera and his friend Angel Navarez were way ahead of the curve.
We were able to sense the drone was coming because we're connected to the border.
He means the border with Mexico.
The border is the first place in the U.S. homeland, so-called, where the drones are deployed. And so I think artists working in the border zone are almost like time travelers. We can see the future of what's going to come.
Back in 2005, they were reading about Border Patrol vigilantes flying homemade drones, long before the U.S. government. They wondered, what would a Mexican drone look like? The first image that came to mind was a flying lowrider car. I know it sounds like a joke, but Alex makes films that subvert Latino stereotypes, and he genuinely loves lowriders.
The car is supposed to deliver a person to work. These cars don't do anything except show off their paint job and their form. It seemed like that would be an interesting form to merge with a drone and to say we could make a drone that wasn't functional. It's not a drone that wants to surveil. Instead, this drone just wants to hop and wants to dance.
So they bought a little quadcopter, which is like a cube with four propellers. And they totally tricked it out.
We gave it all a gold flake and chrome paint job. The rotors were candy color and sparkliness, and you never see on a drone, right? The drones are always painted this matte gray with a paint that reflects radar.
They flew their low drone across the border back and forth, spliced together the footage, and then put a fake remote control on their website. Now, I actually thought I was controlling the low drone from their site. I was a little disappointed when I learned that it was faked. But Alex is like, come on, cut us a break.
When we built it in 2005, it seemed more like satire. I think this website has become more and more possible to people. So when they visit it now, it feels like completely plausible. Oh, I know I'm in New York City, but I'm controlling this machine in Tijuana, and why not?
They're fun. 2 experience the state of the art, I met up with Danny Saltero at MIT in Cambridge. He builds drones that can swim, crawl, and fly.
You can control where it moves and how fast it moves. For example, I can make it drop down. I can make it stay level. I can make it just like rise up really quickly. Let me land it here.
Ooh, you just landed that right in your hand like a pet owl. I've been watching a lot of Harry Potter. Anyway, a few years back, Danny got this strange call from his boss. She said a dance company in New York called Palabolas wanted to develop a show between their dancers and his drones.
We just went inside a big room, and they just told us, okay, just start flying around, and we'll sort of take notes.
We started out by saying, what do they do?
Itamar Kabovi runs the dance company.
We said, could you land it on our head? Could you land it on the floor? Could you land it on our nose? Before too long, the choreographers were making engineering suggestions, and the engineers were making choreographic suggestions as to how to tell the story.
They ended up creating a show called Seraph. It's about 2 species that discover each other, one metal, the other flesh. The sets and costumes are very minimal, and seeing a man on a dark stage confronted by drones, it's hard not to think about Pakistan or Afghanistan.
At the same time, we don't want to nail those associations down too specifically. Because if you nail them down too specifically, it starts to become like a cautionary tale about Afghanistan. And I think especially when you're using dance and sort of metaphoric movement, that can be pretty embarrassing pretty quickly.
After a performance one day, the dancer said something to Danny Saltero that kind of shocked him.
The dancer in the piece actually told us that the 2 different quadrotors in the piece had different personalities that sort of reflected what the 2 pilots' personality was. So that was really surprising. But then you actually, when you think about it, it makes sense.
So what was Danny's drone like? It was just like him.
The robot that I flew was sort of a more mellow yet sort of fun personality. It was sort of like playful, kind of like kiddish. I don't want to get into trouble. I just want to like sort of stay cool with everyone and have fun. And the other robot was more of a tough mom figure. Actually, the guy who flew the robot is a Marine.
New technologies can seem creepy at first, but drones are just another way to extend what we already want to do. See the world from really high up, bring stuff to people really quickly, and sometimes kill our enemies in hard-to-reach places. The day will come when we'll wonder how we ever got along without them.
If we wanted to say, like, oh, hey, or nice to meet you, we would sort of just, like, wiggle it.
For Studio 360, I'm Eric Molinsky. Can you make it land in my hand?
Sure.
Who's a good little robot? Who's a good little robot? Yeah.
Woo! There he goes.
You can watch that dance piece that Eric talked about between humans and drones and see some pictures of the other drones at studio360.org. And while you're at the website, I urge you to take a look at the French band Phoenix's amazing new music video. Yup, shot from a drone at Louis XIV's Palace of Versailles. I wanted to know exactly how drones suddenly got to be everywhere, in pop culture as well as real life. So I asked MIT professor Missy Cummings. She's one of the advisors on our Science and Creativity series, and she spent 11 years as a Navy fighter pilot. She experienced the dawn of drones firsthand from the deck of an aircraft carrier.
And when I saw how eye-wateringly awesome this plane was at landing itself on an aircraft carrier, I started to really have some concerns about where I was going to be as a pilot in the next few years. Uh-huh. And then at the same time, the Tomahawk missile had started to come online that was also GPS guided. I said to myself, you know what, these two things are going to come together pretty soon and they're going to obviate me. And that's pretty much what happened.
And you've got a PhD in engineering, so you know how aviation works in a deep way. But does having been an F-18 pilot help you better understand and research drones than just some dude who's, you know, studied?
Absolutely. In fact, I'm not sure how other professors do it without having been a fighter pilot first, because it really helps anchor me in particularly in the ground control station designs. How do we actually design technology that works for people? I probably lost 24 friends while I was in the Navy that crashed because of a bad interaction with the system, either poor design or their misunderstanding of what the system was doing. And, you know, and that really helps spur me on as a personal motivation to developing better aviation systems, which has kind of spilled over now into all kinds of advanced control systems like nuclear power control.
There's also, I see, a growing consumer market for drones. You know, there are these little quadcopters that are sold in gadget stores and shopping malls. Is there anything new about those that make them differ from the radio-controlled airplanes that were around when I was a kid?
The difference between UAVs/drones today as opposed to remote-controlled planes or helicopters is the level of autonomy, the level of smarts. So when you have a remotely controlled plane, you still have to turn a stick left and right to get the plane to go left and right. But in an autonomous aircraft, you tell it, I want to go left, and then the plane figures out how to make itself go left.
Uh-huh.
And it also theoretically should have on board enough smarts that if you lose the communication link, there's actually something called a heartbeat that always goes between two remotely controlled, the ground control station and the aircraft. And if you ever lose that, the aircraft should know how to get itself down out of the sky without hurting someone. That's certainly where we're going. And by that, I mean that drone development and in fact, the most innovation that's happening in drones right now left the military sphere about a year ago. And increasingly, we're going to start to see some of the big leaps happen in the commercial world.
We've seen, not surprisingly, in the last few years especially, drones appearing in Bourne-type movies chasing usually the hero and trying to kill him. That probably isn't great PR for the unmanned aerial vehicle world, is it?
Well, and I think you've hit on something really important. I believe that one of the reasons drones, they get such a bad reputation is because we can actually visualize them. And this is something where we're getting it from the movies. We can see that movie. We can visualize in our head that a UAV or a drone could be coming after us and spying on us in some way. But in fact, your cell phone is much more likely to violate your privacy than a drone ever would. And certainly your use of Facebook or other social media sites is exposing you to much more liability. But it's hard for us to kind of envision the bits and the bytes flowing back and forth and how people are stealing our electronic records and how they're making sense of that in their big data mining efforts. And so I think it's just harder for your average American to visualize how a program like PRISM worked, which is actually far more intrusive into our everyday lives than any drone ever could be.
I read that you prefer, as the world of this world does, to prefer to call them unmanned aerial vehicles, UAVs. But I hear today you're using drone unhesitatingly. You've given
yes,
in.
Yes, well, I've had a turnaround of thought, right? Because I'm a person who does the psychology of technology. And for a while, myself and a bunch of people in the community were adamant that you shouldn't call them drones because drones connotates a negative stupidness, if you
right.
will, about the technology. But then as I've been talking and I lecture around the country and, in fact, around the world, I've actually had a change of heart. I think that the real reason people like drone is because it's one syllable. It's a lot easier to say than unmanned aerial vehicle. And the media can have so many more cute twists on words, like droning on about drones, drat those drones. So, you know, I actually think that the rest of the drone community needs to step up the plate. Look, that's what people call them. That's what they want to say. We should just go with it.
And in this case, I think also, in addition to the one syllable, it's almost onomatopoeic. It's drone, you know?
I think that's a great insight, and I'm going to totally plagiarize you on that
Excellent.
One now.
Missy Cummings, thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much.
Missy Cummings is Associate Professor of Aeronautics and Astronautics at MIT.
Won't you tell her, please, to put on some speed? Follow my lead. Oh, how I need someone to watch over me.
Coming up, the invention of modern American poetry.
It's amazing because you see him kind of writing, this is what the poet will do, and then you see him break into what would become this major poetic revolution, this free verse.
Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. That's the next episode in our series American Icons, just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, celebrating 10 years of making their own tracks with the limited edition Scion 10 series. The vehicles are available now. You can learn more about the limited edition Scion 10 series features and music release downloads at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Nobody knows for sure, but this might be the voice of a 70-ish Walt Whitman on a wax cylinder recording from around 1890, reading his poem, America.
America, center of equal daughters, equal sons, all alike and good, grow, ungrow.
It's hard to hear. He calls America a center of equal daughters, equal sons. And he captured us the way we like to see ourselves, strong, ample, fair, enduring, capable, rich. No poet ever loved this country more than Walt Whitman. It's a love that in the poems can sometimes get a little uncomfortable. For our series on American Icons, we asked reporter and poet Sean Cole why he so loves Whitman back.
This is a facsimile of the first edition.
Oh, wow.
T. Hunter Wilson is the guy who first turned me on to Leaves of Grass. He was my poetry professor at Marlborough College in Vermont. And yes, he and I are such Whitman geeks, we can even get excited about a facsimile. It's almost an exact duplicate of the original.
It's about 8 by 12, something like that.
8 by 10.
So there's a kind of even visual generosity to it.
But it's slim and hardbound, like a high school yearbook. The cover's a deep green. This was the first of about 7 editions of Leaves of Grass Whitman published. Instead of putting out new books, he just kept adding poems to this one, and re-editing it and re-releasing it with the same title. This first version came out on or around July 4th, 1855. Fitting, because when Leaves of Grass first landed on bookstore shelves in Brooklyn and Boston, it was like another American revolution had started, a poetic one. Except, no one was sure at first who started it because there was no name on the title page. It just says Leaves of Grass, Brooklyn, New York, and opposite that, a picture.
Oh, there he is.
That's not what a 19th century author is supposed to look like. This is a hayseed. This is slightly baggy pants, standing with hand cocked on his hip, and his hat pushed back, looking sort of as if he's about to say, well, that's an interesting point of view.
Whitman put only 12 poems in the first edition. Long ones, but 12, and none of them had titles yet. He makes his intentions plain in the preface. The United States themselves are essentially the greatest poem, he says. And its people, the way they talk and carry themselves, their candor, these, he says, are unrhymed poetry. It awaits the gigantic and generous treatment worthy of it, which is what the following 81 pages are supposed to be.
I celebrate myself, and what I assume you shall assume. For every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul.
Leaves of Grass would ultimately become what Whitman wanted it to be, American poetry's Bible, its origin story.
I sound my barbaric yawp over the roofs of the world.
And some of his fans these days are as devout as religious followers.
Do you take it? I would astonish
Does the daylight astonish?
Every year, dozens of them gather by the East River in Brooklyn and recite the poem that came to be called Song of Myself into a microphone. I went to the 10th annual reading.
What is a man, anyhow?
It featured a famous poet named Martine Espada.
I celebrate myself, and what I assume, you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you. I loaf and invite my soul. I lean and loaf at my ease, observing a spear of summer grass.
Well, I think I was first introduced to Whitman at high school age, and I didn't understand what he was saying. And so I put Whitman aside, and many years later came to Whitman on my own. And it was as if I had discovered the source, my poetry, to be sure, and so much other poetry that I loved and admired.
By poets like Pablo Neruda and Allen Ginsberg. Only, unlike them, Whitman didn't have Whitman before him as an influence. And as far as Martine Espada is concerned, Whitman wasn't just ahead of his time. He's ahead of our time.
Whitman was a visionary, and we, in many ways, as a society, are not ready for Whitman. We're not ready for his radical egalitarianism.
I am not the poet of goodness only. I do not decline to be the poet of wickedness also.
We're not ready for his sexuality.
Morning, how you settled your head athwart my hips and gently turned over upon me.
We're not ready for Whitman.
Or we break off whatever chunk of his book we think we can use. Folks who go to him for the pro-democracy stuff might ignore the gay parts. Or, in claiming him, the gay community might slough off the really graphic hetero parts. Like Whitman says in the book, he contains multitudes. He was also one of the multitudinous working throng. Unlike the popular poets at the time, William Cullen Bryant, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Whitman didn't go to college. He didn't even go to high school.
One of the things to keep in mind about Whitman, and one of the things I find charming, as it were, about him, is that his formal education ended about age 11.
Kenneth Price teaches English at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and co-edits an online Whitman archive. He says Whitman got his real education from newspapers, working for them, I mean, setting type and then later reporting.
Words were passing in front of his eyes all the time, and he also had a kind of sponge-like memory, and so he would pick up high learning and quackery, pseudoscience and real science.
And would he just then mix all those things sort of together in his brain into one mush and then...
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, Emerson famously said that the Leaves of Grass was a combination of the Bhagavad Gita and the New York Herald. And
Ralph Waldo Emerson, that is. And he pretty much nailed it. Emerson was an early fan of Whitman's, which makes sense. Years earlier, Emerson had published an essay saying, "We need a truly authentic American poet for once." And Whitman read that essay and said to himself,
"I will be that poet."
T. Wilson, my poetry professor.
And so Emerson's enthusiasm is a little like catching a view of himself in a mirror and not quite realizing that that handsome fellow is himself.
Right. Of course he liked it.
And at the time, Whitman needed all of the support he could get.
Some of the really negative reviews urged him to commit suicide, or they said that he ought to be publicly whipped.
The quote is even better than that. It says, "We, who are not prudish, emphatically declare that the man who wrote page 79 of The Leaves of Grass deserves nothing so richly as the public executioner's whip." Let's just say page 79 is literally climactic. But Whitman was just getting started. Some of the later work was way more explicit.
Explicit enough to have had Emerson have second thoughts and sort of walk through the Boston Common with him saying, "You know, Walt, I don't know that you really ought to. Couldn't you take that out? You don't really need that in there."
Oh, is that what they were talking about?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now, you'd think Emerson would be worried about the homoerotic poems. But the man-on-man love in Leaves of Grass is so soft focus and handholdy, you really can't tell what's going on. No, what Emerson was concerned about was a sequence of poems called Children of Adam, which is all about procreative love between men and women. I read through part of it with Ken Price, and I feel weird saying this since we're talking about 19th century American poetry, but if you have kids in the room, this may not be appropriate. Okay, here's me with Ken. It is I, you women. I make my way. I am stern, acrid, large, undissuadable, but I love you. I do not hurt you any more than is necessary for you. I pour the stuff to start sons and daughters fit for these states. I press with slow, rude muscle. I brace myself effectually. I listen to no entreaties. I dare not withdraw till I deposit what has so long accumulated within me. Through you, I drain the pent-up rivers of myself.
Yeah. It gets pretty close to being like a rape scene.
Rape scene, yeah.
And that rightly troubles people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think this is not a, one of Whitman's best moments, and it should be criticized. To me, the most logical explanation is that when he's talking about relationships between men and women, he's really entirely imagining it. It's not something based on personal experience.
But what's fascinating about that is he's using his muscle to start the new republic.
Betsy Urkola is a Whitman scholar at Northwestern University and author of a book called Whitman, the Political Poet.
It's more almost a fantasy about the role of the poet in creating the democracy of the future, the kind of planting the seeds, pressing with the seeds that are going to produce the democracy of the future.
That is, the straight sex in the book isn't sex so much as a metaphor for Whitman's political ideals, at least in this case. And in her book, Betsy Urkola argues that the source of Whitman's seemingly out-of-the-blue inspiration was political, right down to the new poetic form he invented, that long, unmetered line he's known for.
I always like to say he broke the pentameter. He broke the pentameter.
What does
that
mean?
This is the line of Shakespeare.
Oh, I see.
And the line that our language in some ways naturally scans
so it's
in.
It's like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Exactly.
So my mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun. Whereas with Whitman, there was no set number of beats per line. That was his real innovation. And Betsy says there's this one particular moment where he broke the pentameter, one passage in a notebook dated 1847. He's writing about the kind of poet he wants to become.
It's amazing because you see him kind of writing, this is what the poet will do, and this is my image, and then you see him break into what would become this major poetic revolution. This free verse. And where he breaks is at the lines, I am the poet of slaves.
And of the masters of slaves. I am the poet of the body. And I am.
And then breaks off.
Literally, he breaks off mid-sentence there, stops, and then tries again. I am the poet of the body. And I am the poet of the soul. I go with the slaves of the earth, equally with the masters. And
I will stand between
the masters and the slaves.
How fascinating that this major break in poetry worldwide comes over one of the most pressing political issues of the moment, right? That was threatening to tear the Union apart.
And ultimately, that poem, though not exactly as he initially wrote it, went into Leaves of Grass.
I am the poet of the body. And I am the poet of the soul. The pleasures of heaven are with me, and the pains of hell are with me. The first I graft and increase upon myself, the latter I translate into a new tongue. I am the poet of the woman, the same as the man, and I say it is as great to be a woman as to be a man. And I say.
And once he discovered the line, once he made that breakthrough, he did something so incredibly modern that we usually only associate it with poets 100 years after him, like William Burroughs, for example.
William S. Burroughs, Brian Geisen, you know.
Matt Miller is a poet and a teacher at Yeshiva University in New York, and he wrote a book called Collage of Myself, Walt Whitman and the Making of Leaves of Grass.
If you look at this.
Holy cow.
You can see. These are each individual strips of paper, and there's more than one.
What he's showing me is a scanned image of an original Whitman draft, but each of the lines looks like it was snipped with scissors from somewhere else and glued into place. You can actually see the glue stains here and there. According to Matt, Leaves of Grass is a word collage, a cut-up.
Well, his number one source was his own text, mm-hmm. but it comes from writing that was not originally conceived of as poetry. Prior to 1847, he published some juvenilia, some early...
Not very good poems.
Not very good poems. Not they don't look like Whitman poems. A lot of them are very conventional, short-lined, sometimes even rhyming poems. But aside from those poems, he wrote prose. He wrote notes. He wrote in the margins of other books. He wrote letters and all of these things, book reviews. All of these things wound up becoming Leaves of Grass, wound up getting cut up, stirred up, mixed up, reformulated, sometimes revised, sometimes not, sometimes just moved around. And I think Whitman invented that.
Whitman published the first edition himself and controlled every part of the process. He even laid the type on the printer himself. He put out 795 copies, most of them sold. The second edition, which was a run of 1,000 copies, did not do as well. For the third edition, he had an actual publisher, Thayer and Eldridge in Boston. They went bankrupt a year later. The book never really took off during his life. Whitman once wrote that from a commercial standpoint, it was worse than a failure. In the fourth edition, the book took a turn. This was in 1867, so just a couple years after the Civil War, during which time he famously tended to injured soldiers in Washington, D.C. And he documents that work and a lot of the darkness of the war in this version of the book.
The Wound Dresser is the poem.
Again, Ken Price.
And lines from the Wound Dresser poem are etched into the top of the DuPont Circle metro station in Washington, D.C.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And here I am, and the quote is etched into this wall that sort of sweeps around the escalators in a semicircle. You actually have to get on the escalator to read the whole thing. It says, "Thus in silence, in dreams, projections, returning, resuming, I thread my way through the hospitals. The hurt and the wounded I pacify with soothing hand. I sit by the restless all the dark night. Some are so young. Some suffer so much. I recall the experience, sweet and sad."
Which is beautiful. And I went back and looked at that poem again in the book, and these are the two lines that come immediately after that passage. "Many a soldier's loving arms about this neck have crossed and rested. Many a soldier's kiss dwells on these bearded lips." Like Martina Spada said, we're not ready for Whitman in a lot of ways. Those two lines will probably not be chiseled into a building anytime soon. There's a lot more to the story. Leaves of Grass got Whitman fired from a government clerk job. It was banned in Boston, but as always, banning it just meant lots more sales later on. And he was publicly lauded during his life by the folks who recognized his genius. Overall, though, America just didn't love him as much as he loved it. Still, at the end of the final version of the book that came out the year he died, in a wistful, bittersweet essay that caps the whole project, Whitman wrote, "I have had my say entirely my own way." What could be more American than that? Let's try this one. For Studio 360, I'm Sean Cole. Put my hustle down, tore the game up, took your high score down, put my name up, tore the doors down to the Hall of Fame. It's Jigga, I did it my way. Much more than this. That's right. It's a beautiful thing, man. I did it my way.
This fall, we've chosen 9 new American icons to bring you, but we want you to pick the 10th. One recent suggestion came from listener David Elsey of Boston, who's read a certain Kurt Vonnegut novel again and again and again.
Ooh. I don't count anymore. Probably once every couple of years.
This is Schlachthof 5. 5 is English 5. Schlacht is slaughter. Hof is house. Schlachthof 5. Slaughterhouse 5.
It's a book about the absurdity of one war that was told during the height of another war's absurdity, that I think stands for the absurdity of all war. And it's approachable. Students can identify with what's being said there, as well as sort of laugh at the adults, which I think Vonnegut does well, is that he presents primarily adult human beings as buffoons, which is really not far from what most teenage readers tend to think of adults as anyway.
So, tell us, what novel or TV show, play, symphony, poster, or any other piece of American culture do you think really embodies America? Visit studio360.org/American Icons, click on the map there, and give us your nominations. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you so much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel, Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julie Dorio,
Dylan Piers McCoy,
Felicity Sheehy.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bennett. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, celebrating 10 years of making their own tracks with the limited edition Scion 10 series. The vehicles are available now. You can learn more about the limited edition Scion 10 series features and music release downloads at scion.com. And by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, Artworks. Studio 360's American Icons project is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Great Ideas Brought to Life.
Much more than this, I did it more.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the uncanny power of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
David C.
Anyone can relate to a name. If you've given birth to a child, if you've held a baby in your arms, if you've baptized someone and say, I name you, this wall will break your heart.
Kenneth J. Powles.
Next time in Studio 360's American Icons from PRI and WNYC.